Welcome. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm the coordinator for humanities collections at Michigan State University. We have these events to advertise collections and services of the library. The Michigan Writers Series is an advertisement for especially the Michigan Writers Series collection, which is in special collections. There's many notable collections that are part of the Michigan Writers Series, and especially the papers of Richard Ford and Tom McGuane reside in special collections within that, the parameters of that series. Tonight's reading is from poet, writer, public interest lawyer, and law professor Brian Gilmore, who teaches and resides in the College of Law at Michigan State University. Brian Gilmore is a poet, writer, public interest lawyer, and law professor in the MSU College of Law. His two books of poetry are Elvis Presley is Alive and Well and Living in Harlem from Third World Press in 1993, and Jungle Nights and Soda Fountain Rags, Poem for Duke Ellington and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, Caribou Books, 2001. He is a columnist for the Progressive Media Project and has received the Individual Artist Award from the Maryland State Arts Council in 2001 and 2003, was a Cave Canem Fellow in 1997, and was a Pushcart Prize nominee in 2007. His poetry has most recently been published in Jubilat, Beltway, Osho 23, and is forthcoming in the Sugar House Review. So please welcome Brian Gilmore.
Oh, man, it came off. Thanks a lot for that introduction.
Feels awkward with this thing, right?
Chocolate City Blues. Sugar Mama, I met in the wee wee hours. Was it 10 years ago or was it 30 days? Sugar Mama who gave me the key to the highway. Sugar Mama who got my mojo working. Sugar Mama whose toes I would kiss. Sugar Mama, the light of my eye. Sugar Mama makes me drink hot whiskey. Sugar Mama had me running around house looking for a drink. Sugar Mama too good to me. Sugar Mama evil. Sugar Mama like smokestack lightning. Don't start me talking, Sugar Mama. Don't start me talking. You have to reconsider, baby. Reconsider what you've done. Because I'm a man, Sugar Mama. I'm your hoochie-coochie man. I'm waiting by the telephone, just waiting by the phone. I've got the almost empty liquor bottles and empty pack of smokes. Got the worried life blues, Sugar Mama. Got the blues with a feeling. Because it ain't no secret, Sugar Mama. This is the first time I met the blues. Seems like 10 years ago. Only been 30 days. King of New York. It's about a guy in my neighbor, old neighborhood who became more famous than people around there who probably should have been famous. But this is called King of New York. He was shot in the chest, close range, with a German Luger, badass Ricky Jay, who wore a blue Peter's jacket with the collar turned up, and blue jeans that hung off his butt. And you could see he wore boxers. Only the coolest guys wore boxers and let their jeans hang. Briefs were for dudes who went to school, didn't smoke, who didn't hang out late at night. People were afraid of him. Even the dude who walked up to Ricky with his father's German Luger, shot him when he was in someone's car, was afraid of Ricky Jay. The story now is he wasn't even after Ricky. He was after the driver of the car. But Ricky took the bullet for all time, made us all forget about the men who mowed the lawns, the women who hung clothes, all those fabulous people who kept bologna and cheese on wheat or white on the table. Like the high joker in Spades, we all remember him. We still say, this is the corner where Ricky Jay was shot. 1974, in a car, in the middle of the day, they rushed him to the local hospital, but he died. He created something difficult to handle, like Robert Johnson, 28 or 29 songs, jumping trains, going nowhere, really. Chicago, some woman, some man, somebody has to die. bury him in some unmarked grave. Ricky couldn't fight either, it was always said. He didn't go to school, got arrested, smoked cigarettes, set his mother's house on fire. But they will always remember Ricky. Boxer shorts, drooping jeans, cigarettes, grabbed a gun, opened the door to forever. You don't want to be hanging on corners drinking cheap wine. Someday, years from now, bumming change, getting laughed at by some young boys, listening to Tupac Shakur. Too young to know you wrote some songs, loved some women, made this neighborhood a place where people remember the smell of coffee in the morning. All I want to know is why he set his mother's house on fire. Why does no one remember the men mowing lawns, the women hanging clothes, the people who kept the lights on as we walked these streets, acting like he was some great blues singer or something, as if he's Marvin Gaye, born here in Deanwood, 1939, shot and killed by his daddy, Los Angeles, 1984. Fat Albert. I am not Bill Cosby. I am not Alexander Scott. Do not ask me of Cliff Huxtable, Lisa Bonet, and especially do not utter the name Fat Albert. If you want to know, he's locked up. He has three kids out of wedlock. He's evading child support. He's not spending time with his children. Fat Albert, last I've heard, has type 2 diabetes. Then there is his love of marijuana and hypertension. Not to mention bench warrants in three other states for some prior bad acts. Still, I will not speak unkindly of Fat Albert. We asked for swordfish, they brought us bologna. We asked for swordfish, they brought us sardines. We demanded swordfish, they said, we'll give you all cheeseburgers, but we get Fat Albert. So here we are. New York Avenue. Excuse my voice. I rarely write about my career as a lawyer. I did public interest law, but I did write this story. It's called New York Avenue. It's about somebody came into my office one time. I was working in Southeast DC, poor section of town, and this is the story. For 18 years, she worked as a housekeeper at a little motel on New York Avenue. She worked so long and hard, her spine turned into cracker crumbs. Her ankles became grapefruits. He soaked her feet every evening for 15 years, popped Tylenol like lifesavers. Always came on time to work. Never took off except for funerals. Never asked for anything except the keys to the room she had to clean. This she did for 18 years at a little motel on New York Avenue. Last month they asked her to take a pay cut, forfeit her health benefits, pension, membership in the union. This they asked this black woman after 18 years of dedicated service. She told him she changed too many beds to begin sleeping on the floor, scrubbed too many toilets to be treated like waste, picked up too much trash to be turned into garbage. She has nothing now, no pension. Her life is a disability check that barely pays the rent. The first Latino woman started right after they fired her, and all the other black women. Roberto was the new manager. He had worked his way all the way up from maintenance. Roberto told the owner he could save the motel. Roberto the manager. He knew women who would work here for less money, who needed work, who had no time for strikes, walkouts, demands, money-draining expenses. There are no pensions, unions, health benefits. There are no more black women who are about to collect their pensions working here. The world moves like a checker on a game board, like a sniper in the bushes. There are no more steel mills in Gary, Pittsburgh. A lot of buildings are boarded up in Detroit. People are sandwiches. black housekeepers named Angie, Diane, Deborah, Pearl. Tonight, I get a room at the motel on New York Avenue, make up my own bed, take out the trash myself, leave money in the room on the dresser, take this poem, fold it neatly, place it in the drawer beside the Gideon Bible or the stack of telephone books. Two copies, one in English, el otro in Espanol. Trading places. Oh, man, how y'all doing? This is about New Orleans after the flood. Once again, excuse my voice. Feels horrible, though. This is called Trading Places. Carla called us, and she lives in Richmond now. She's my wife's best friend. She is from New Orleans, and she called right after the storm. The one that rose up like Zeus to wash away the people, like ants on some hill. And we knew why Carla had called, because we had been watching CNN. And we knew that she and all the others perhaps could have used a boat or a raft, some clothes, some food, and some rosary beads. All day we could see that people were barely making it, like in some sad old Richard Wright story, or like in Ernest Gaines's The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. And it is 1927 all over again. That's why Carla was in Richmond now with Doug Wilder and Arthur Ashe, up south like the millions, where the Great War was fought, and her shotgun house down in New Orleans. Those wonderful glimpses of who we are not so long ago was no more, she said, and her job was no more. And she taught school down there in the Big Easy, so she as well was no more, in a way, and that life of hers out near the fairgrounds with her kids and her mother, out there with the ordinary, regular people who deliver mail and teach school. I am not talking about Canal Street or Bourbon Street, because there is more to this than just throwing beads at people on floats. Because Carla's mother made the best crawfish pie in the history of New Orleans, and she is alive and still down there, Carla say, still down there ready to wage jihad with the insurance man who is speaking in tongues about water and wind and water, and we cannot pay unless you are married to Huey Long. And even if you are, we are who we are. That's all. We are who we are. Because if word gets out that we paid, we are like those two dumb old cats in Trading Places who bought a crop report from an ape's boyfriend with Eddie Murphy laughing at them until his sides hurt. This is what Carla say from Richmond, where the Great War was fought, long way from fried alligator, pralines, jambalaya, etouffee. And I am remembering the time at Jazz Fest when Fats Domino came out of retirement dressed in an all-white tuxedo. We were in Carla's yard eating her mother's crawfish pie, and Fats was rocking a white baby grand. And he played all of the songs that are what we are now. And not far away, the Nevilles played the greatest version of Big Chief ever recorded. I am sure you remember Big Chief. Fess is rocking the 88s like Fats Waller doing Steel Pan. And Earl King, don't forget about Earl King, bluesman Earl King from New Orleans, because Earl and Fess would have needed a boat too, a raft, some food, and some clothes, and some rosary beads. And they would have been all over CNN walking through that water, or all over the newspapers, just like Fats Domino when they fished him out with his hair matted and his heart broken, ready to die. And Fats didn't have on a white suit. He didn't really look like Fats anymore. Can you picture that? They didn't even know it was Fats Domino when they saved him. Ain't that a shame? Ain't that a shame? Ain't that a shame? And Carla, my wife's very best friend from New Orleans, she lives in Richmond now. I went to the... I wrote this poem after I went to the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. And you know, it's so funny. You always hear about, you know, Dr. King's killed at the Lorraine Motel. But, you know, you really have to go there. And then you know, this really did happen. You know what I mean? It's not real until you walk in there and they left the room the way it was when he walked out and got killed. They probably restored it, but everything is like the same. They're like, this cannot be, don't move anything kind of thing. You know, you really walk in there and you're just like, man, that really did happen. They blew this guy away, you know what I mean, for, you know, what he stood for. So this is called the Lorraine Motel. Sometimes we have to ride down a street where a building burned down to know there was a riot. Go visit someone in jail to understand murder. Call out to Jesus. Tell Lazarus to come forth. Wait to hear footsteps before we are ready to fight. Mahalia sings the blues in the hallways of this place. No matter what, it will always be just a motel. Precious Lord, take my hand. I think I smell gunpowder. See people running in a panic. Someone in the bushes snickering loud like they want to hear. Everyone to hear. We get the motel, they get the world. We get the memories, they get the future. We get the blood, they shape the message. There was blood on the pavement running like water from those fire hoses. Remember the fire hoses when you are in Memphis. I hear sirens off in the distance. Mahalia's voice, the sound of footsteps. See beautiful photographs on the walls of this motel. Never forget how to call out to Lazarus. Someday you may have to ask for a place to stay in a museum. I write a lot about my crazy childhood, so to speak. I grew up in D.C. It was a lot of fun. And also write a lot about my parents and the kind of people they were and things like that. So I'm going to read a couple of these here. See if they make sense of anything, right? Nosferatu. Anybody know who that is? Nosferatu was the... Oh, I know you know. That was the original name of the first Dracula film, Nosferatu. So this is called Nosferatu, but it's not about that. It's more about my childhood. Not childhood. It's more like as a teenager. My childhood is a distant memory. The kid... In the colorful long sleeve silk shirt, the 70s, the summer heat, making love to the streets, worshiping asphalt, stay out later and later, vampire, throwing rocks at streetlights, alley lights, just needed to be night for the love of the streets, just adore the streets, and malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. A mother hears a streetlight explode. She knows her boy was wearing a colorful silk shirt when he left here this evening. It's summer. People wearing long sleeve silk shirts in summer don't think rationally. Remember the music, that crazy, ridiculous music that almost did us like the dinosaur. John Travolta doing the foxtrot, looking like he's dropped acid. Bell bottoms, stacked heels, afro sprayed with something toxic. But really, it isn't the shirt, it's malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. She calls out her son's name, he's gone, like Kaiser Sosa losing his limp. Really, he's Bela Lugosi and has become a bat. Flown and jumped in someone's car, ready to worship the streets, the asphalt. He looks insane. Short shorts, long tube socks up to his knees, and his shirt, long sleeve silkness. Go nowhere without it. His music, disco inferno, boogie nights. He laughs at this stuff. But another streetlight will be gone soon. He doesn't know why. And later, when the city cools off like hot apple pie, when the men drop their rods in the water on the river and pop open ice-cold bottles of Miller High Life, the kid in the colorful long-sleeved silk shirt will stop by someone's house. They will pop bottles, too, and a toast to malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. I like in these series of poems here, this is from a manuscript that probably never get published, right? We always say. But this manuscript is called My Father, Vladimir Lenin. It's a lot about my father and then his and, you know, where he came from. He was from Baltimore, working class town. So this is a piece called Avalon. It's taken from the title of that film, Avalon. It's about Baltimore. But, you know, it was great to go as a child, to go up from D.C., which is a bourgeois town, if you ever been there. A lot of black people who they had money and means and things like that, educated, thought they was better than, they think they better than all black people in the whole United States. I could tell you that for a fact. That's what they believe. But, and then go to Baltimore and you see the enormous poverty of the black people up there, just up the road from D.C. And you also see enormous poverty amongst the working class whites who worked at the shipyards and who didn't have jobs anymore and things like that. But this is called Avalon for Aquila Sr., who is my grandfather, and Hazel. This is about my father coming back after he served his time in the service, saying, what am I going to do? The son ponders his departure in the middle of the night. His parents asleep in their creaky Baltimore row house heated by stoves. There is nothing here for him in this city anymore. That is why he has come. He wants to be sure. His father, an insurance man, sells no more policies. His mother has long since immersed herself in mail order vitamins, scripture, lukewarm glasses of tap water boiled pure. The son's older brothers have not returned from the wars. His sisters are busy trying to marry. The son's life is cold concrete, dead of winter. His father built something in this dog of a city, a colored man keeping the lights on door to door the old way. 10 children into the world, no prisoners, no prostitutes, hot meals, warm beds. His boys wearing war medals and making ends meet far, far away. The son has a bus ticket to the capital of the world just down the highway. He don't know how to tell his father that there is nothing here anymore but crab meat and football. He has never liked crab cakes, and he can read about Johnny Unitas and the Colts in the newspaper. Pops, he thinks to say, an old woman fell down some stairs today. I helped her up, but she just kept falling back down. Father will not say a word. He will not understand no matter what the son says. Makes no difference anyhow. This is Baltimore. 1951, a city organized by railroad tracks, the South Side, numbers racket. In the morning, the son rides that bus to the city down the road, buys the Washington Star when he arrives, walks to his sister's home from the bus station, and briefly wonders when the Colts will play the Giants. His mother will be ready with ice-cold water boiled pure on the stove. His father will talk insurance, but will never again sell any policies. A soldier story. My father once told me that he learned how to type. And so when you go into service, they try to figure out, okay, where are you going to end up? You going to be out there on the front line and bullets flying at your head? Or you going to be somewhere else where you won't be getting shot at? So his whole thing was, he scored very high on the test and he knew how to type. So they put him in processing, and he didn't have to go to Korea. And he always said, as many blacks got killed over there. It was only 55,000 blacks got killed over there. There was like 25% of the whole take people killed in Korea. He said, chances are he wouldn't have got out of there. But he said, people don't know that a lot of blacks, just as many black men were killed in Korea, like just as many as Vietnam. It was the same kind of thing. Just as many, I mean, the United States had like 55,000 killed in Korea. I think in Vietnam it was like 56,000, something like that. It's very close numbers. But Korea is a celebrated war. Vietnam was our defeat, so to speak. I don't know if those numbers are exact, so don't quote me on that. But it's not for real. But they talked about that back then, that, man, a lot of people got killed in Korea, too. Nobody ain't mad about that. You know what I mean? So this is my father. I will not die in Korea. My children born. Thousands of colored men, dead like ants who have crawled too far for crumbs. Harry Truman, given hell. Executive Order 9981. This is what could have been. What wasn't shall never worry. I meet the man on his grisly turf. I never meet the rising sun. So many colored men dying like middle passengers dragged here by ship. NAACP loud like locusts. Coast Guardsman Haley scratched the word. Charles Wrangell, Harlem hero. Hell-given Harry wants to rule the world. I came down to the city of government, learned to type, got a good government job, GS 1 or 2, something to talk over with gin and lime. I meet a graduate of Paul Dunbar High, pretty lady who spins some tales, writes like the queen, doesn't fret about how it be. She walks behind Charles Drew, good God of blood, Jesse Fawcett, well-mannered with word. Her shorthand is a poem. Civil service exam, freedom train, days full of rooms and men. She dances dark streets where she is told to stay. Her mother out pounding the pave, buying the bread, bringing the South up north for respect. Thousands write letters, send dollars for more. No more hot sun, cow milk days, fields of rice, corn cake break. World Bank like crop share crooks, trapped in bricks, but give glory to God. I didn't die in Korea. I was lucky. My children born. I was courteous to the pretty Dunbar woman. I came to the city, got a good government job, fell in love with shorthand, talked about it humbly over gin and lime. But most of all, I learned to type. And my father once took this job once. And it was like at the Pentagon. So they really had to look into you, who you was, who you are. And come to find out, his father was a communist, so to speak. He used to get the magazine. Back then, you could get the magazine. They didn't say you were a communist. But they could say, like, yeah, you're a sympathizer. You know what I mean? Now you pretty much have to declare you're a communist. But his father used to get People's World. He was in a union in Baltimore. He was a union organizer, so he was a communist. So this kind of came out, and then this is like, give you some time frame. This is like, you know, I'm kind of small, very young when this happened, and a lot of things in our family happened. Not really real bad, but this is a poem about that. And my mother was the main one who told this story. It's called Make It Plain for My Mother. My mother laughing at government men. My father has taken a new job. With folders and documents, they're telling my mother she married Karl Marx or Engels. This is the source of her chuckling. My father, Vladimir Lenin. My father, author of the Communist Manifesto. My mother must have typed it. Disseminated copies to the workers of the world. Today, she would have emailed it as an attachment. But this is 1955, comrade, and my father's whole family is trying to laugh about it. They are Paul Robeson, Du Bois, Langston Hughes, or Dashiell Hammett insisting upon handcuffs rather than a microphone. Is your father Karl Marx? They ask all of them. How do you spell proletariat? What brand of cigarette did Lenin smoke? You mean he smoked? I hear he quit cold turkey before he died. And Karl Marx, well, comrade, didn't he play for the Brooklyn Dodgers or something? This is not funny. We know about your father, a union man, Baltimore, tried to organize a few things, get people to band together in the workplace, like ants when they see a cracker fall. He reads the People's Daily World. Your father's a bowler, right? Formed a team, and some of you were members. And at the bowling alley, you didn't keep score. You just said, nice shot, comrade. My father's sisters and brothers no longer laugh. Two of my aunts almost lost their jobs because they could bowl. My father got interrogated for days because he knew how to pick up a spare. And my uncle, a clever man on the lanes, he spent his 2 years stint in the army in a Kansas mess hall, being spied upon like he was KGB. They gave my father the documents, the records, the job. He died with those secrets. My father always liked to bowl, kicked his leg out like Earl Anthony on ABC's Wide World of Sports on Saturday afternoons. My mother liked to bowl. She had a purple ball and ate cheap French fries with all that Heinz ketchup dripping slow. She couldn't stop chuckling at the government men that day. Lenin, unions, October revolutions, it is all a bit too serious. And Karl Marx, my mother says, I'm sure he never played baseball. I went to Howard University for one semester. Can you believe that? Don't laugh. I did. My father went there, and his brother went there. And if you was in D.C., if you got in Howard, you were supposed to go. You were supposed to go and graduate. But, you know, me and Howard never saw eye to eye. I don't know what it was. To this day, I can't explain it, but I'm going to read up. If I can find it. Bear with me, right? All right, here we go. I think. The pages are stuck together, that's all. All right, this is called 2001 Space Odyssey. But I did eventually go to college and finished. But this is, I left Howard, and then this is what I did. I have finally done it. I've told my mother and father that I want to go away to college. To a small, predominantly white college in the mountains of Western Maryland. Their faces are a double Mona Lisa. They rewind. It is years ago. I am in the living room of our home with my mother and father, tell them I am dropping out of Howard University. I am showing them my report card, all W's. My name at the top like it's a police rap sheet. My mother isn't saying anything. Her face says that what I've done is so stupid, there isn't a word in the English language to describe it. My father doesn't get it either. He graduated from Howard in 1960 from the School of Business. He did 4 years in the Army, tended bar, waited tables to pay for his education. I try to explain it to them. The black people at Howard are not black, I say. They're not like the people I grew up with. My father says, they're not supposed to be like the people you grew up with. That's why we sent you to Howard. There is endless silence, like in that movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey, when Hal the computer was acting a damn fool, and the man keeps asking, open the pod doors, Hal. Open the pod doors, Hal. But my parents do support me. I'm headed for that exit near Baltimore, right before you enter the Fort McHenry Tunnel. Try to turn this mess I made into a work of art. Try to make Mona Lisa look back at me one day and start grinning. So I went to this school that wound up being like a Ku Klux Klan stronghold, if you can believe that. What an idiot, right? You're going to leave Howard and go to the Klan country, Frostburg State College. What's that? Frostburg State. It's in Frostburg, Maryland. Just between West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, right where those three states cross, right there. So this is called Jaws. These are like little snippets of my experience. As we cruise through the campus, there isn't a black face in sight. I am a slug after a rainstorm. Salt has been poured. My father reaches the administration building, urges me to go pay the bill, so he and my mother can go home. It is all so quick. In the building, I look up front of the payment line. I finally see a black person, a young girl who looks petrified. We're both on that raggedy boat with that stupid shark hunter who thinks he knows it all. That eerie music has started. It is getting louder. Around midnight, my mother and father have been gone for hours. It has sunk in like hands into potting soil. I am all alone. I imagine my parents back in the city laughing loud, asking themselves, why did he do this? How could he have traded in a jazz club for an 8-track of live bluegrass music? Zebrahead. At this college that is 92% white, in a county and city that are 95% white,
My roommates are, of course, white. They love Run DMC. Reefer Madness. At the predominantly white college way up in the hills, one of my very best friends is a guy whose entire family seems to have a lifetime membership in the Ku Klux Klan. At his house for a visit, I realized that all he and I have in common is getting high. And they say marijuana is harmless. Animal House. To join some drunken fraternity, they don Ku Klux Klan robes, bearing the slogans, "I hate Jews. I hate niggers." We call them out, ask for them to be sent home forever. We get labeled serious, like some long-winded post-Civil War speech by Frederick Douglass. They get diversity training. The Nazis would have loved this place. You can listen to klezmer music, jazz, read Saul Bellow, Richard Wright, shoot our grandmothers, become a brother. Don't think it was all bad, though, right? Y'all don't think it was all bad just from that, do you? All right. Let's see if I can find something more pleasant, right? This is called Godfather 2. This is for my daughter, Lyric. This is when she was 2. I wrote this. She's like, how old is she now? Godfather 2. There's actually a Godfather 1, and it was for the first child, my first child. This is Godfather 2. Marlon Brando is dead. My daughter will only dream of him. She and I shall go to the waterfront and see that he does not sleep with the fishes. But he's gone nonetheless, like those kids from New Jersey Drive riding like cicadas on the wrong windshield. Marlon Brando is dead. My daughter will never know him. Only Don Corleone can speak to her now, a silly man who talks as if he's trying his best to sound like Miles Davis. She and I shall watch his movie over and over, just as I did in college, law school, and any time I wanted to feel as if I were loved. Marlon Brando is dead. Michael did not come to save him. He and Enzo got lost on their way to the hospital, and the Don is now gone. Now my daughter will never meet him or have a chance to love a Sicilian. Here is a man who loves his daughter, I could have told her. Here is a man who would save the world. Marlon Brando is alive. He was saved by us all. Years from now, I will invite him to my daughter's wedding so he can watch us dance before the world. He will have the greatest time eating our food, listening to our music. People will come visit me in the parlor, and he will watch them ask me for favors. I will point to him and tell them that there is the man they need to speak to. A man who will make you offers you cannot refuse. A man who will come to see you late one evening and ask you if you love your children. Hoop Dreams. This is for my oldest child. The morning before the big game, in the cold of March, I show her the crossover. How to get past the defense with just a little bit of jazz. She's post-hip-hop funk soul on the hardwood. Allen Iverson, Clyde Frazier, Earl the Pearl. Moving the ball from left to right, leaving the defender standing there like the first time one sees a jellyfish in the ocean. First time one watches cornbread getting cooked on top of the stove. And in the big game just a few hours later, the one she shall remember like a first ride on a roller coaster. She did it. Just like I had shown her in the chill of that March morning.
just like someone had shown me so many years ago when I was post-swing bebop. A washed-up rec league baller is officially retired now. He dribbles in his dreams, late-night hog calling, flesh and bones. Sorry. How y'all doing? So I drove through my old neighborhood a few weeks ago, and this is called New Jersey Drive. I'm not from Jersey, but that's from that movie, New Jersey Drive. I really like that movie because it's all about the old neighborhood, so to speak. But I just wrote a piece about that old neighborhood. It's so funny how your neighborhood is changing, your old neighborhood. On Orange Hill, behind the flower shop, barber, laundromat, a long row of stores, we set fire to the future. Someone's backyard catches our hell. Tony with the matches, me with the paper, Willie with the big pile of dry leaves. Welcome to California. One of those wildfires we catch on CNN all the time now with beer and plenty of popcorn. This one was a warning. We are lost. Save us. Our parents have to work long hours to make the ends meet. The schools don't teach us to love ourselves or who we are. Let me recap it for you another way. We were drunk. We set someone's backyard on fire. They were not having a barbecue. We ran off laughing. Everyone around the way knew we did it. Younger boys thought we were cool. We were their heroes for life. Okay, no one got hurt. Or did they? I went to college. Tony went to the Air Force and went half crazy. Willie became an airman too, and he did lose his mind. Then he joined the Pentecostal church, and he pulled it all back together, speaking in tongues most nights. I don't know where they are. I am the only one who sees Orange Hill these days. I ride by and stare at it. The burnt grass has grown back. Their family is long gone. The flower shop, barber, laundromat, all those little stores that were there have been torn down. Condos are being built, an organic market. When my kids are riding with me, I can't help but to say, I almost lost my mind right there, up on that hill. I point. They say the same thing every time. Daddy, there is nothing there. Just read a couple more. Let me see. This is called Watermelon Man. Anybody see that movie called Watermelon Man? Y'all ain't see that movie called Watermelon Man? What's that? I like that song. I'll just read a piece of this one. This is called Watermelon Man. Watermelon Man is about the guy who was white and he turned black. It's on Netflix. So, there's no excuse. My brothers and I watch a movie called Watermelon Man. It is really stupid. No one turns black by sitting under a sun lamp and eating soy sauce. And no one ever told me not to sit on the back of the bus or the security guards might follow me in stores. I used to look at pictures of young Elizabeth Taylor and thought she was gorgeous. I saw Natalie Wood strip half-naked in Gypsy and was in love with her forever. Elvis Presley movies never bothered me at all, especially Viva Las Vegas. My mother made the best spaghetti sauce I've ever tasted. She has never been to Italy. My father read Rousseau and Martin Luther. My sister liked the Beatles. My grandmother was born on a plantation in Texas. My other grandmother picked cotton all day until her hand swelled up and bled. She didn't keep any of the money she earned. She makes homemade biscuits. She baked one hell of an apple pie. She always kept Confederate dollar bills tacked to the wall in her home. She gets a pension check today from changing linen all day for 30 years at downtown hotels. I still watch Watermelon Man every year. It is an awfully stupid movie. Security guards follow me in stores even now. Sometimes I stop them and ask, "Don't you think Natalie Wood was beautiful in Gypsy?" They look at me and start laughing.
part three of this same piece. I am from Baltimore and Louisiana and Texas and Sandtuck, South Carolina, where train tracks meet Coca-Cola signs. Old men ride rusted bikes or wear white suits, sell insurance door-to-door, fight wars in Cuba, almost die from malaria in Santiago. I am a gang fight in Baltimore where they throw wrenches at each other in the street and laugh at the old woman who boils all of her food, orders vitamins from Prevention Magazine, is living well after Vietnam ended, and remembers the war with Spain. I like fried chicken and meatloaf and peanuts and gumbo, and I listen to Billie Holiday or Jimmy Smith. I got on the coal train for Big City one day in Union, South Carolina. Got here with black dust all over my best Sunday dress. Brushed myself off, learned how to read and write. When I walked to school, my teachers walked up the street next to me with their heads held high. They lived right around the corner from me in the city. Boxer Joe Lewis was always in the neighborhood hanging out with one of those ladies. Thurgood Marshall got his hair cut for court here. He was from Baltimore. He never touched soy sauce. He didn't boil his food. He ate steaks, drank scotch, smoked cigarettes. I want to be a lawyer like him. Now, I'll end with a piece from my book here, Jungle Nights and Soda Fountain Rags, which is a book about Duke Ellington and the Duke Ellington Orchestra that was published years ago. It was out of print, but I'll just read one piece in here, and it's the last piece in the book, and it's Duke Ellington. And it's for Mercer Ellington, who's the person who's responsible for Duke Ellington's legacy, so to speak. And I always liked it because I had a close relationship with my father, and Mercer Ellington didn't have a close relationship with his father. His father belonged to the world. He did a great thing in that he sort of gave his father away to the world, so to speak, because he turned over all of his father's archives to the Smithsonian, and that the Ellington legacy is real, if you know anything about it. But this is called Things Ain't What They Used to Be, and it's for Mercer Ellington, but it's about, you know, a son's love of his father. Comes the son to clean the house, move the chairs, sweep the floors, put the books back where they belong. Get the house ready for the world, though the head of the house will not be home. Comes the son like Ralph was to Martin, pass the word to guests who have come to look at the house, read the books, hear what was said, what it means. Like an extra in a film, the son was there to love the man but not the father, or the father and not the man. Like we loved the man and never knew the father, and he let the father become what he had to become. Stepped to the side like a bullfighter with a red cape, took the father's paint into his hands, smeared it all over the earth, gave it to everyone who wanted to know how it felt to be blessed, because only one person painted this house, talked to these walls like they were a woman with a broken heart. And what was painted on these walls would never be forgotten, like the first kiss you ever had, like the first long walk along a river with a lover. Came the sun to go away like things ain't what they used to be, fading from a radio in the house full of friends. People who have come to hear about a man in his house and how he painted the house slowly. Why they all love the man and all that he was and will be. Why they try their best not to ever get lonely in this house that can never go quiet and will never again need to be painted. Thank you very much for coming out. You may have any questions. You don't have to ask one. I'm not saying you have to. I really appreciate it.
You know, I thought really enjoyed your reading and kind of, you know, the language I thought was very vivid, and the way you juxtapose your personal experience cultural references and some of the things were poignant, and then using humor, a lot of things that a lot of nice contrast.
Thanks.
I like that, and you know,
some surprises. So it's a nice mix of imagery and some good tempo, good pacing, and that really, keeps it from, sounding just so, poetic. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like it's not like you're just like, I'm writing a poem. You know, it's sort of you took it somewhere that was original and gave it more meaning, so that it was your own, your own individual take on it, which I thought was nice.
Thanks. I never felt like, I really wanted to, it just didn't feel like I belonged at Howard for some reason. If you were from D.C. and you were a black person, you went to Howard if you were trying to achieve, or you went to another HBCU if you couldn't go to Howard. But if you were in D.C., you tried to go to Howard University. And, it was at a point you could only go to Howard. That's what I should say anyway. You couldn't go to any of the other schools anyway because it was all segregated before, like, the 50s, and then you could go to other schools. But still, those schools ended up having to, like, Frostburg was one of the schools that got sued, to desegregate. I mean, they had to be sued, and that was all the way up into the 60s and 70s. Those court decrees were still in effect. So, but when I got there, I just didn't feel comfortable with it. I also had gotten into Morehouse in Atlanta. I got into Delaware State. I just didn't go. I don't know what it was. You know what I mean? I think college is a point where people are soul searching, and you're sort of seeking out your place in the world, so to speak. And I just felt like this is not my spot. I mean, and it's very interesting. If I would have stayed, I wonder how things would have turned out. I mean, I was a communications major. I wanted to be on the radio, but it didn't work out. And then I went somewhere else, and, lo and behold, look what happened, right? But who knows? I just don't know. But a lot of people, I mean, friends I went to high school with, they went to Howard, boom, they did 4 years, bam, got out, got themselves government job. When I go back to D.C., I see them, and they're like, I say, you almost retired, right? And they're like, got like 5 more years to go. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. I felt like they made that choice, and that's kind of like how it was. But I was sort of like, I don't want to do that. Go to Howard and get a job, like in industry somewhere, and then because that's what Howard produces. They produce people who are going to work for the corporations, government. Some go on to law school. If you go back to the yearbooks in the 50s, 40s, go back 40s, 50s, 30s, 60s, every famous African American you know of is in that yearbook because it was just, that's where you could go. You could only go there. You had to go to one of those schools because it was segregated. You couldn't get into the other schools couldn't get into the other schools unless you was passing, so to speak. Otherwise, you were stuck.
Did you finish at the
high
school?
Oh, yeah, I finished Frostburg. I did.
You did
draft
somewhere.
No, I finished. It was actually like the right thing. It was actually the right thing. It sort of was, I was more mature at that point, and then it was sort of enlightened. I was like, because when I got there, the big thing was South Africa and Nelson Mandela, free Nelson Mandela, and the student movement was big, and I got involved in the student movement. And it was a good time. Ronald Reagan was president. I remember that vividly. So it was probably right for me. I can't say it was right for everybody, but it was right for me.
Right.
No, you couldn't. You definitely couldn't say that.
Right. So I thought that was the positive thing.
Right. I mean, it was. I don't even know. My father went there. My uncle went there. I mean, everybody known in D.C. Even now, it's so
people. It's some connection. Like when Howard's homecoming, which is probably coming up, it's when it's Howard's homecoming, it's the whole town, black DC's homecoming. I mean, you had people there, they ain't never, there's people there, they ain't never finished high school and they show up every year. Yeah, man, homecoming. You know what I mean? But it's different now because now you have choices. Like,
you have a choice, so that's right. What I was thinking about
now. Right. It's definitely totally different now.
Yes, totally
different. Right. Go ahead.
Feedback, comment. I've heard good poets are not good readers. Or good readers are not very good poets. You're a great poet. Thank you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot. I wish we got a bigger crowd for you all, but when I started out, we said, you read to who comes. And that's what I said to him. So
that's
how I always do it. When I've been to readings with 1,000 people, and you seem like you didn't connect at all. Went to a college in New York, seemed like you didn't connect at all. I'd done readings with 3 people, and I knew I connected.